Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
We really do want to thank you for coming out tonight to support the Tattered Cover and your independent bookstore. It's very much appreciated, so that we can have folks like Philip Kerr here tonight with his latest Bernie Gundermist. So let's welcome him and hear about the latest escapades of Bernie.
Thank you, Pat. The real Philip Kerr can't be here, obviously, and he sent his avatar in his place, or at least that's how it feels to me, because these days to be a writer and to be an author are sort of slightly different, and you have to be like two different people. The real Philip Kerr is antisocial, misanthropic, hates to travel, is painfully shy, and woefully inarticulate, and so therefore he prefers his double to come and do this sort of thing. The idea of schizophrenia and having a double is quite important in my family. My mother is a Brodie, and she her dad was Thomas Brodie, and he was a master craftsman carpenter in the old part of Edinburgh. And he claimed he was descended from a very famous Scottish burglar called Deacon Brodie. I don't know if any of you have been to Edinburgh. Well, if you may have gone, and you may have seen a place called Deacon Brodie's Tavern, which is famous for selling the largest number of whiskies in the world, or so they claim. A very Scottish claim. Deacon Brodie was hanged at the toll booth in Edinburgh on a gallows of his own construction, because he was a carpenter too, in 1763. And the reason they were particularly pissed off with him was because while by night he was a burglar, by day he was a respectable member of the town council and had sat with all these people and had passed laws. And one of the things they decided to do was build a new gallows in the town, and so naturally that was the gallows they hanged him on after he'd built it. Now, as well as building the gallows on which he was hanged, Brodie made furniture, and one item of furniture that he made was a closet, or a wardrobe as we say, which found its way into the family of Robert Louis Stevenson. And Stevenson had this closet in his nursery. And since this was Edinburgh, and since very likely he had a sadistic Scottish nanny, she used to tell him that if he didn't behave himself, the dark man who'd made the wardrobe would come out and steal him away. So you can imagine what kind of childhood Stevenson had, and why it doesn't seem so unlikely, therefore, that he would have written Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which was indeed inspired by the story of Deacon Brodie. Stevenson really means us to think of the story not as a sort of parable of having a double life, in the sense that you drink a potion and become somebody else, but it's really about being a writer. It's about having a respectable job by day, by like being Dr. Jekyll. And then at night you come home and you sit in front of the blank piece of paper or the laptop or wherever, whatever, and you do or become whatever you want. And indeed, that was my life for a long time. I would work at Saatchi's, and I'd, as Pat said, you know, write nothing of any great consequence. And then I'd come home in the evening and I'd become this other person. Now, that's my mother's side of the family. On my father's side, you've probably heard of Freud's princess syndrome, the idea that we're descended from rather more illustrious forebears than the ones who the poor people who are actually are our parents. And in my dad's case, this was sort of true. Because when he was 22, he had to apply for a passport because he was going away with the army or something. And he discovered when he went to the records office in Edinburgh that he didn't exist at all, which was a bit of a shock to him. So he sort of stood there wondering what to do. And then the person, the clerk in the building, obviously made a suggestion, because doubtless this had happened in Edinburgh many times before. And he said, well, why don't you look under your mother's maiden name? So he looked under his mother's maiden name, which was Hannah Nimmo. And there was no child born to Hannah Nimmo either. And she said, no, there's nothing. But there is a Lily Nimmo, if that helps. And he said, ah, yeah, it does. Because Lily Nimmo was, in fact, his aunt. At least that's what he thought. Although it turned out, indeed, that she was his mother. And why it becomes slightly exotic, I suppose, is because Lily Nimmo was the housekeeper for a rich New York family. And had got knocked up, possibly by somebody in the family. I don't know. More likely by the butler whom she subsequently married. It's very kind of remains of the day, this story. You know, it's Emma Thompson and Anthony Hopkins. Except there's a happy ending in the sense that they do marry. Anyway, she farmed my dad out to her sister, who was then childless, promising that one day she would send for him back in New York. But in fact, they stayed in New York for the rest of their lives, she and the butler, and never sent for my dad. And it kind of ate my dad up, actually, because my dad was a great Americanophile. He loved this country. And it really cut him up that he couldn't have been the New Yorker I think he always wanted to be. And he came here a few times, and I could see, you know, I mean, I didn't understand everything, but I knew there was some yearning he had to be here, instead of which, of course, he had to live in Edinburgh, which is a dump. And, I mean, let's face it, you know, if you could live in New York or Edinburgh, I mean, not necessarily now, but back in the 50s and 40s and the 50s, believe me, in that time, it wasn't so hot. And, so there we are, you see, but for a small accident of fate, I could have been speaking to you in an American accent. And instead of which, I'm speaking to you in this received pronunciation that I have, which, of course, is not the accent I was born with. I was born with a Scottish accent because I, too, lived in Edinburgh. And possibly as a reaction to the circumstances of his birth and the fact that his putative mother was an alcoholic. My dad and my mother were very religious people, very religious. So religious, in fact, that they were originally in what was called the Free Church of Scotland. And believe me, there's nothing free about the Free Church of Scotland. It's the most small-minded, bigoted, petty, prejudiced bunch of Protestants on earth, I shouldn't wonder. And that's saying something in Scotland. And anyway, they decided that this was too harsh and unforgiving an environment for a child to be brought into the world. So they, when I was arriving on the scene, they decided to become Baptists instead. Out of the frying pan, you know. And into the baptism well. And my sister and I used to go to church three times on a Sunday. Three times. We went in the morning service. We went for Sunday school in the afternoon. And we would come back in the evening at 6:30 and endure the whole thing again. But you see, right from the word go, I knew it wasn't going to happen to me. I wasn't going to be a Christian for the very simple reason. Once a month, the floorboards in this church in Edinburgh would be lifted to reveal, and I apologize if there are any Baptists here for making these remarks about Baptists. I'm sure it's a wonderful thing. The floorboards would be lifted to reveal a small swimming pool, about sort of 7 or 8 feet by probably 4 or 5 feet. And people would then, 6 or 7 people would be, would come forward and stand at a microphone, much as I'm speaking to you now. And the curious, weird, creepy thing to me was that they were wearing kind of shifts. The men would wear a black, long black shift, like they were going to die, actually. The sort of thing you would wear in a coffin. The women would wear a white one, which was almost diaphanous, but sadly not. And then, having told the congregation that they were sinners and they were going to invite the Lord Jesus into their lives and everything would be good, they would then descend into the water with the brick-faced pastor who ran the place. And he would then duck them under the water, much as John the Baptist did with our Lord. And then they would come out born again, dripping wet, of course. But I knew, see, this would never happen to me because I'd had a small accident in a swimming pool when I was a kid. And I'd fallen in and possibly half drowned, I don't know. But I had an abhorrence of having my head ducked under the water. And so I watched this every, you know, few weeks and thought, it's never going to happen to me, you know. So because of this, I used to just switch off and I would get my little notebook out and I'd start writing. And that was one of the earliest memories I have of writing rather than listening to religion. I'm telling you these things so you can see the dark psychology of the creator of Bernie Gunther. I'm often asked, you know, why, you know, you write these dark stories. Well, you're finding out. I'm going to tell you a story now, which is even more shocking, actually, about the birth of my writing talent, let's say, using the word broadly. When I was about 6, I suppose, my mother gave birth to a second daughter who was called Fiona, but sadly she didn't live for very long. The headmistress at my school, junior school, was called Miss McKendrick, and she didn't like me because I was dark, and indeed that was true of quite a lot of other Scots who thought I was probably a bit of an import, actually. Shows you how ignorant the Scots are, actually, that, you know, they actually, I was sometimes accused of being black, believe it or not. But compared to the sort of red-haired, green-eyed, freckled-faced sons of the soil that they were, I suppose, you know, I was the nearest thing to, you know, somebody from another country that they'd ever seen. But there we are. Anyway, we would have lessons. Being a Scottish school, we had lessons like handwriting, punctuation, grammar. Anyway, I remember in a lesson for punctuation that I'd been sort of idly, you know, I suppose, improving the full point I'd made at the end of a sentence. And Miss McKendrick looked at this, looked at me, and then slapped my face hard. And I sort of felt the sting of this for hours after it had happened. And I nursed a little grievance against this woman. About the same time, she knew about the birth of my second sister Fiona, but she didn't know that Fiona was dead. And I think at this point I should give you a little comparison. Think of me as a little bit like Christina Ricci in The Addams Family, Wednesday's child. She's got that sort of wonderful little sideways look, you know. Well, that's kind of what I was like. Because Miss McKendrick would inquire as to the health of Fiona, you know, over the next sort of week or two, 3 weeks. Weeks passed. And I don't know that I was plotting anything particular. It was just a kind of, it was something I knew that she didn't. And I was, you know, I was just, it was a kind of power, I suppose. Well, one day she asked me, how's Fiona, Philip? And I gave her the Christina Ricci look and I just said, she died ages ago. And the look on this woman's face was study. It was the, if you like, it was the moment when the ape touches the monolith in 2001. Because at that moment, I realized the sheer power of story, of alternating upon reality. I realized that making stuff up could give you an edge, an advantage, in a way that just sort of being a meek little truth-telling sod never could. So my dad... So that these are little two events that I sort of always hold as the sort of key moments about starting how to becoming a writer. My dad paid me the enormous compliment of having an index of prohibited books. He had a top shelf in a cupboard that he used to lock as books that were not suitable for a small boy. And we're not talking sort of hardcore porn or anything, unfortunately. It was just sort of, it was Ian Fleming, Harold Robbins. There was a very good book by Aldous Huxley called The Devils of Lou Dutton, which I thoroughly recommend if you haven't read it. It puts Stephen King, frankly, you know, back a long way. I mean, this is a marvellous, marvellous book. Not necessarily the book you want to be reading when you're sort of 9 or 10, but there we are. Another book, of course, that was on my dad's shelf, because this was the 1960s, of course, was Lady Chatterley's Lover. And so I read this book, and of course, I was aware it had a very powerful effect. You know, I wasn't quite sure why, but it was a highly enjoyable read, I thought. And I thought, this is the book I most want to take to school. Because back in Edinburgh in the day, there was nothing like this to be had anywhere. You know, I mean, there was, you know, now, you know, you see pictures of half-naked women all the time, you know. But back in Edinburgh, not a bit of it, you know, there was nothing like that. So I thought, well, my dad will miss this if I take it out of the cupboard. So I thought, well, why don't I just write something in the same vein? You know, I can remember, you know, roughly... you know, what's going on. So I used to, I wrote this story, which I called The Duchess and the Daisies, because I thought the aristocratic bit was quite good. And anyway, and the bits I, you know, obviously I couldn't get to the original very often. So I just made stuff up. And then I took it to school and sort of showed it to a couple of friends, and they thought it was marvellous. Especially as I'd also by that stage sort of illustrated it as well. Because I was a very good draftsman, actually. I've got to say, I was a much better drawer than I was a writer. I thought, well, I can make some money out of this. So I started to rent it to the other guys in the class, which just shows you how desperate they were, for the princely sum of threepence a night. And, one day, my dad got a phone call, and it was the father of another boy whose dad had... Do you know what your son's been writing and what he's given to my boy? And so he gave the story to my dad, who then, true Scotsman that he was, made me read it to my mum. She didn't stay for the good bits, as it happened, but she could tell which way it was going, you know. So you can see that writing was... Well, I can see, again, it had a very powerful effect. But after that, I started to keep my writing to myself for a long time because I thought it was just safer. So, and we had a thing called... once a week, we had a thing called composition, which was you had to compose a story about anything you liked. And so I would really put my whole soul into this one sort of piece of homework per week. But even then, I sort of encountered, you know, the stupidity of teachers, because the teachers would say something like, "Philip, what an imagination you've got," as if that was a problem. And I used to think, what's the deal here? Because, you know, I'm supposed to make a story up, but then it's not got to have imagination? I don't get this. And then the other thing they used to say apropos of this was, "Write about what you know, Philip, and then you'll be on more solid ground here." And I remember saying to one teacher, "Well, I don't know anything because I'm a kid, right? I'm a schoolboy. But frankly, look, Shakespeare didn't write about what he knew. because he didn't go to Italy, as far as I can see. He didn't go to Denmark, and he certainly never went to Scotland. Lucky boy. And they'd say, well, you know, it was kind of, well, that was an unanswerable, you know, question, you know. So I never used to think this was a problem, write about what you know. You know, I thought, well, that can't be true. And so it never held me back, not knowing about what I was writing about, as it were. And I'm going to give you a little thesis, if you like, which is when I came to write about Germany and Berlin in the 30s, it didn't inhibit me particularly that I didn't really know about it. Because it seemed to me the best books about Berlin, and I'll get to why I sort of come back, why I chose this subject in a minute, but it seemed to me, with Berlin, the best writing about Berlin, the best stuff, the best, I suppose, the things that create the clearest image of what Berlin's all about, were written by people who weren't from Berlin, like Christopher Isherwood, Stephen Spender, W.H. Auden, who went there for cheap sex in the 1920s. Nabokov was there at the same time. He wrote Laughter in the Dark and Despair, and excellent books. And then, come a bit further on, you've got Len Deighton, you've got John le Carré, who, in my opinion, has written possibly one of the greatest novels of the second half of the 20th century. I mean, I do believe that The Spy Who came in from the Cold will define a period of, you know, 40 or 50 years in a way that no other book will. I think that's one book that really will last the course of time. So these guys were not from Berlin. And even more recently, we have David Bowie releasing a single, which is a kind of homage to Berlin, a rather sad, you know, elegy to his time in Berlin. And, of course, Lou Reed. So you see, what Berlin is a place that you go to with an attitude of mind, and you encounter Berlin, and it doesn't, and everybody encounters a different Berlin, because it's one of the most Protean changing cities in Europe, and always has been. It's been changing since the unification of Germany in 1871, because almost immediately the Kaiser set into motion a rebuilding program, which frankly pissed off the Berliners, and they're still pissed off, because Berlin is the most rapidly changing city in the whole of Europe. Every time I go there, it looks kind of different. Huge, great statement headquarter buildings go up all the time. And the people who live there sort of grumble about it, and sometimes they do a little bit more about it. In 1848, of course, they had a revolution, and this is why people like Bismarck and the Kaiser hated Berliners. They feared them and distrusted them. Hitler hated Berliners because he knew they were really the only people who'd not voted for him in any great number. And even today, Berliners fear, especially East Berliners, not East Berliners in the old sense, but people who live in what was East Berlin, quite often young people, students, and they distrust the what they call the yuppification of the area. You'd call it gentrification, I suppose. So much so that in 2011, there were 370 luxury cars burned, torched in Berlin. So it's not a place you leave. East Berlin's not a place you leave a nice car, posh car, because what happens is they come along with two little firelighters and tuck them under the rear tires and set them on fire and then go. And it's just a kind of typical fuck you reaction that Berliners have, which I personally love. You know, it's one of the things I love about Berliners is they're so independent, let's just say independently minded. I mean, Berlin is the one place on earth where the customer is never right. If you can go into a shop and you can ask for something, you know, like a camera, and you say, well, I'd like to buy the new Fuji X10 or whatever. And the guy will say, well, why? You know, it's a shitty camera, you know. So then you have an argument, you know, about whether it's a decent camera, it's worth buying or not. And I kind of love that, actually, because they are very, I mean, they had years of people telling them what to do. And so, you know, they it's like a muscle that wasn't sort of flexed for a long time. I also love the Berlin sense of humor. People are always saying to me, well, you know, you write about Germans and, you know, do they really have the sense of humor that you describe? Well, they do, really, but it's a very Berlin sense of humor, which I feel very much in tune with. It's a kind of brittle, sharp, jagged, black, noir sense of humor. And it's at its best, I think, in the film Cabaret, which was based on Isherwood's book, with the MC, who was wonderfully played by Joel Grey, who's fantastically bitter and sarcastic. And I think the high moment of the film is when he sings to the girl, you know, if you could see her through my eyes. And it's to a gorilla. And at the end, it said, if you could see her through my eyes, she wouldn't look Jewish at all. And it's just fantastically sort of horrible as a joke, but it's terribly effective. So this is my... I like this sense of humor. I think there's something about the Berlin sense of humor that the English do quite like. We're always sort of... The English are always having a little go at the Germans, but the fact is the Germans like the English quite a lot. I mean, even Hitler liked the English. His favourite film was Lives of the Bengal Lancers with Gary Cooper, which says a lot, really. Why did I think I wanted to write about Berlin and Germany in the 30s? Well, I did I always wanted to be a writer, but, you know, obviously fathers persuade their sons to do something different, you know, because, you know, they worry about them being unemployed and all that sort of thing. So my dad persuaded me to be a lawyer. And I had no aptitude for the law at all. But I was quite good at one part of the law, which was jurisprudence. And so putting off the inevitable, I did a postgraduate degree in German law and philosophy, which was, frankly, just a way of reading German philosophy. I wasn't particularly interested in the legal part. But whilst doing that, I sort of got really interested in the philosophical and cultural circumstances that created the climate in which Nazism was able to thrive. And it's a really interesting subject, actually. You know, it's about pan-Germanism, it's about romanticism, how the romantic movement was inspired by Napoleon, and then even by Darwin. You know, it's a wonderful mix of things that get sort of emptied in. So I got interested in this subject, but it didn't occur to me for quite a long time that I should write about this particular subject. I mean, I went through the motions of writing lots of other stuff, because while I was failing to be a good lawyer, I decided to become a copywriter in an advertising agency for the very simple reason that I'd looked at the biographies of lots and lots of other novelists and had realized that quite a few of them had been copywriters. And it seemed like, well, that's obviously a job you can do, which suits being a suits being a novelist. So that's what I did. And it didn't occur to me for a long time that why they chose this job was because you could actually write novels while you were in the office. And indeed, that's what I used to do. I'd sit there in front of my IBM Selectric typewriter typing away in my novel, and people would look round the door and say, oh, Phil's working, yeah, leave him. And they'd assume it was, you know, like sort of Mad Men, you know, I was working on a piece of vital copy. And in fact, I was usually working on my novel. And in Saatchi, I was really in the complete ass end of Saatchi and Saatchi. And finally, you know, they were very glad to see me go. But the irony of the situation is that now I know Morris and Charles quite well, certainly Morris. And Morris always introduced me as someone who's come up through the school of Saatchi. And I never really have the heart to say, look, Morris, you know, A, you didn't even know I was there when I was there. And B, you know, I got shown the door pretty sharpish, actually. So so finally, I came around to the idea of writing about Berlin. And I was sort of here. I had a little conceit in my head, which was that... I thought about Raymond Chandler a little bit, because I don't know whether you know, but Raymond Chandler in my opinion, one of the most English writers there is. You know, people think he's, you know, the quintessence of tough American hard-boiled, but in fact, he's actually really British, I've got to say. He went to an English public school, Dulwich College. He was a near, almost contemporary of P.G. Woodhouse. And in fact, I think they have a huge amount in common. There's a melody in what they write, which is sort of almost unique to them. The words just tinkle, and they're kind of laugh out loud descriptions that they both have. And I sometimes wonder if they might have shared the same English master. I've got no evidence for this at all, but I just think it's a possibility. And I used to think, well, what kind of novel would Chandler have written if instead of going to live in Los Angeles, he'd gone to live in Berlin? Would it have been different? So that was one area that sort of appealed to me to sort of think about. Well, I started writing, and I suppose I didn't actually write. I didn't write very much for 18 months, well, 2 years, while I was researching this idea. Because the thing about Chandler that always astounds me is the sense of place, the taste. You can feel and smell Los Angeles as you read the book. And I thought, well, that should be what I aim for with this book about Berlin, which was, you know, the arrogance of youth. It was, you know, a hugely ambitious task in retrospect, especially because at the time, unlike today, there was very little information about Berlin. I mean, now there's been a kind of explosion of books about Germany and Berlin, and every week it seems a new book is published. I know because I get sent them for reviews or for quotes. You know, every week there's something new. But at the time, there was nothing really. There were only a few books, and so I was like a little gold miner up in the Klondike, you know, with a sort of pan, and I was looking for the little nuggets of information that I could seed in my text. And after a while, I began to think of myself as a bit less like a Klondike miner and more like, as I got all these little tiny spots, if you like, I began to think of myself as like a pointillist painter. You know, I love these sort of pretentious comparisons between myself and, say, Georges Seurat. But that's kind of what it's like, because you see, you put something small on the canvas, and up close it doesn't mean very much, but you put lots and lots of small things in on the canvas, and then you take 10 or 15 steps back, and then you see the picture, and the whole thing starts to shimmer, and it comes to life in a way that no photograph can, and you get an impression of a moment in time. And really, that was what I was aiming for, were all these little things. You know, to some extent, I was, you know, it was like being the god of small things, to steal Arundhati Roy's title for a moment. So it was lots and lots of tiny little things that I think create a more solid picture of the place. Well, I'd written so many books before and not got anywhere. I was sort of, when I'd finished a book, I thought, well, what do I do now? You know, I was really nervous because I sort of felt, you know, this really does matter now, because with each novel you write and you don't get published, you think, you know, unemployment, disaster looms and all that. So I went to a party and I met Edna O'Brien, the gorgeous Irish lady novelist, beautiful green eyes, red hair. It's a siren amongst sort of women, female writers at the time. Still is, to be honest. She gave me the best bit of literary advice I ever had, because we got chatting, and I said I'd written a novel. And she said, well, I'll do the accent. Have you got yourself an agent? I said, well, no, I haven't. How do you do that? She said, well, you get the Writers and Artists Yearbook, and you'll get the names and addresses in there. But then, here's what you'll do. You'll do two or three specimen chapters and a synopsis, a CV of yourself, university, age, all that stuff, and a photograph. And I thought, oh, a photograph, well, that doesn't sound very kind of literary, but, you know. And I said, well, are you sure about the photograph? And she said, oh, yes, they're looking for good-looking young people, you know. And I thought, well, great, that's a compliment, you know, from Edna O'Brien. So I thought, well, you know, I'll try it. So I did, and I did exactly what she said, and I had an agent in 6 weeks, I promise you. So it worked. The agents then said to me, well, are you going to do another one? Because if you do, I can get you a two-book deal. And you see, it had never occurred to me. You know, the thing, people look at the career of a writer and they see the sort of the seamless series of books one after the other and assume that you always had some kind of master plan. And I didn't. No, I didn't. All I cared about then was just to get published. And I think that's really all writers care about in the beginning. It's just to get published. But it's amazing how the goalposts start to move, because after, you know, you just to get published becomes a two-book deal, and a two-book deal with, you know, UK and then Japan and then the US, and you start to think, well, you could actually make a little bit of money, and then you start to think, my God, I could actually give up work. And indeed that's what happened. And so I you know, I had the Gordon's Comstock keep the Aspergista flying moment when I, you know, told my boss where he could shove his IBM Selectric typewriter. And you're looking like you want to... I quit and never look back. It was like the moment in The Great Escape when Steve McQueen lifts the sort of turf and he pops his head up, and there's the fence, which is full employment, and there's the trees, and you get out and you're running for the trees and you never look back. And that's kind of how it's been ever since, actually, you know. Well, anyway, I gave up. I did three, and then I thought, well, three, that was a good number, and I should stop, because I always thought, you just don't want to be trapped on the treadmill of doing the same thing for the rest of your life, so you try other stuff. And it wasn't like I just thought I'll give up permanently. It was just that I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll come back to it, maybe I won't. And consequently, I sort of had a disagreement with the publisher, and I left, and I went somewhere else. And in order to, you know, get their money back, they decided they were going to collect all three in an omnibus edition. And they said, we're going to put out a kind of trilogy. What do you think we should call it? And I sort of thought for a minute. Well, I said, well, what about Berlin Noir? And that then was over there. And I carried on writing other stuff. 15 years passed. It's like Dickens, really, isn't it? And meanwhile, Berlin Noir achieved a kind of critical mass. Lots of people read it, passed it on to their friends, whatever. And so I would go on a book tour and people would say, well, when are you going to write another Bernie Gunther novel? And I would say, oh, I don't know. And then after a while, my wife said, well, you know what? You should write another one, but while people are still asking, you know, because one day they'll stop. And I thought, well, that was pretty good advice. So I picked it up again and discovered that there were huge advantages to sort of coming back to a character after a long period of time. I don't know really. I mean, I count myself extremely lucky, because I don't know how many other people have done it. Because normally you kill off a character, or the publisher says, I never want to see you again, you're hopeless, or something like that happens. So to come back to a character after 15 or 16 years seemed like a huge luxury. And I thought, well, it'll work so long as I sort of move him around, a bit like the Flying Dutchman, if you like, as if he goes to different countries and he doesn't always have to stay in the one place, which would be kind of monolithic and sort of dull, really. And so that's why I do that. I've been given a little note here which says, repeat the questions that are asked. So, I mean, let's hope there are a few questions, actually. So does anybody have a question? Gentleman at the front.
Yeah, so the street, there is incredible detail on street names and cafes and what they serve. How did you find that out? Those places were long gone.
Yes, they were. Yeah, they were all long gone. I mean, I've done a lot of tramping around, it's fair to say, and I've, as well as the gentleman asked about how I got the names of the streets and all that kind of stuff, and how the details were Well, it's like I was saying, you know, the details are sort of like panned. They're like little nuggets that you find. And I mean, literally, I would spend maybe an hour reading a book in the London Library or the British Museum Library just to find like one little detail, which I would put in. Yeah, like sort of, yeah, a couple of sultanas. Or better still, like in the movie Casino, when the muffin issue comes up and how many blueberries are in, and De Niro complains that, you know, there aren't enough blueberries in the muffin. So I'd put more blueberries in the muffin, and that's kind of what it was like. For all the research that I've done and for all the collecting of facts, the most important research is the stuff you do in your own head. Because I'm very much a believer in not having professional researchers, because I don't like the idea of having a filter and somebody else deciding what's important. I like to having amassed information to go to a place and put myself in a position where I can feel it myself. So I'm aware of all the facts that I've discovered, but I like the feeling. I like it's like method acting, if you like, if I can quote, you know, De Niro's life again. I mean, to give you a good example, I mean, I've been writing a script quite recently about Munich in the 1920s for the people who did Der Untergang, the downfall. And because Hitler is in the script, I thought, well, I should really go and, well, I tramped around Munich, but one of the things I did was to go to Hitler's old apartment building. And I sneaked in when someone who's still lives there came out and sort of went up the stairs, which are it's exactly as it was when Hitler was there. And I just stood in front of his front door for, you know, about 5 minutes, just imagining what would have happened if I'd knocked in 1928. So that, to me, that's the best kind of research, is because you then can reproduce the feelings that you have if you can draw on that. Another question. Gentleman there.
Kind of the arc of Bernie's stories, you know, pretty well known, it kind of moves all around, you know, as you release the book. And, you know, the ending of Field Gray, you know, just sort of leaves a whole lot of room for, you know, developing. Are you looking forward now, leading kind of the post-war?
Well, am I looking forward from the end of Field Gray, which was in 1954? Well, the honest answer is I don't really know, because I have to wait for the history to kind of lead me by the hand. You see, like this new book, which is partly about the Cat in Forest, I've wanted to write about this for a long time. But there's very little information about Cat in Forest. There are only two half-decent books about it. And I'd been waiting for the eureka moment, if you like, when I found something useful that would sort of kickstart the whole enterprise. And it might have just as been might as easily have been something in 1954. But I managed to find an SS map of Smolensk in 1943, because the Germans drove into Ukraine and Western Russia. And naturally, they thought they were going to be there forever. And this was now the Greater German Reich. So the first thing they did was they remapped the city and changed all the street names and gave, you know, German names. And so when I got this map, that was, if you like, that was the key to the whole endeavor, because suddenly I could see the whole thing in terms of a German place rather than a Russian place, which frankly wouldn't have had much meaning, because none of that would have been accurate. And I guess the other thing that happened was I was so fascinated why the discovery of the first bones, as it were, should have been given to a senior aristocrat colonel of intelligence. Why was he walking in the Cat in Forest? Why did he trip over the bones? Just didn't make sense, actually. And to some extent, it still doesn't, but I've given a fictional reason. This man fascinated me. His name was Rudolf Freiherr Christoph von Gerstorff, and he was an immensely brave man, because at the very moment when he tripped over the bones, he'd at that stage been involved in three plots to kill Hitler in as many months. And that was fascinating to me, that this man, in one plot, the more recent of them, he tucked two landmines in his pockets, because he'd been given the honour of leading Hitler around the Zeughaus, the arsenal, on Veterans Day, because Hitler always turned up and made a speech and then went round the museum. And von Gerstorff was given the honour of doing the guided tour, as it were, and so he had pockets full of explosives, and the idea was that they would go off while he was squiring Hitler around. But unfortunately, Hitler had been to the museum so many times, he'd obviously sort of seen everything there was, and so he just split after only a couple of minutes, leaving von Gerstorff with live pockets, and then having to rush to the men's room to, you know, defuse the bombs. As I say, a hugely brave man. So, I think Pat's looking at me. So we might
one more
question, right? Gentleman at the back. Have any of the books been optioned for film development? Well, that's a story almost as long as the history of Bernie Gunther, actually. But right now, I'm in a situation of, it's quite possible that HBO will turn them into a TV series. Tom Hanks wants to be their executive producer. He's a big Bernie Gunther fan, by the way, Tom Hanks. He came to my house last summer, and it was a rare occasion when you talk to a Hollywood star who's clearly read the books. And he knew the books in almost as much detail as I did, you know. So that was refreshing. So, you know, I'm optimistic that once the lawyers have done their job, for once, that this will happen. Well, now I'll be very happy to sign books. Anybody's got them? Okay, thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.